Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, A History of Ireland in 10 Body Parts is a new book by Dr. Ian Miller. It explores war through our skulls, banshees through our blood, and Irish jewellery through our hands. The journey to our body is filled with stories from across time. And Ian joins us in studio. Ian, good afternoon. Ian is a senior lecturer of medical history at Ulster University. Now, the same question as I was asking Rona before you, what was the light bulb moment that you said, oh yeah, I must write a book on the history of Ireland in 10 body parts?
Well, I'm not sure there was a light bulb moment as such, but I remember one of the inspirations when I first moved to Ireland from England. I went to see the Clonycarvan man, whose body I talk about quite a lot in the book, especially at the beginning and at the end as well. And I was just fascinated, I guess, with the idea that this body could have been preserved for so many thousands of years and just lying there. No one knew he was down there. And I became particularly fascinated as well by the story of how they realised he had Hergell on and how they surmised from that a lot of the trading connections at the time with different countries, because some of the products in the Hergell came from Spain and the Mediterranean. So I started to think, well, you know, what can you learn about the past and the Irish past in particular, just from a body or a little part of the body, such as a hair? So I guess from that, over the years, I'm a medical historian originally from England, and I moved to Ireland, so all my research interests
I've never met a medical historian before.
Really? Ian. There's not too many of us.
No. So if you meet somebody in a bar or a pub or in a cafe, how do you explain what you do?
Most of us are trained as historians first, and we've gone into medical history that way. Some people are doctors, and then they go the other way and then start to write about the medical past. But it's just essentially a branch of social history, just with a strong health or medical aspect to it.
So your, I suppose, area of expertise is telling us, for example, you would know off the top of your head how particular ailments were treated throughout the centuries.
Yeah, specifically the 19th, 20th centuries.
Right, that's your area. Right. And you came over to Ireland. The first thing you did was went in and saw the bog bodies. Clonycarvan man.
Yeah.
So just tell us about him then. When was he killed?
Well, that's a bit open to speculation, but it's sometime in the 2nd or 3rd century BC, so a good 3 or 4,000 years before us now.
But they know he was killed?
He was killed. There's only half the body left, and they don't know if it was killed. The bottom half was taken off in a sacrificial ritual, maybe not, maybe just got damaged over the years by the machinery, being used for agriculture.
Yeah.
So there he lay, and the real good thing about him, you can almost visualise his eyes. His eye sockets are still there. He still has a face, so it's not like looking at a skull. It's a completely different experience. You can see his hair, as I mentioned, so he looks like he has red hair. He may not have done that, the chemicals at work. But just fascinating being it, and you feel like he's looking at you as well, and almost wondering what he thinks of you. Like he's
what age man was he?
I think he was about 25, again, that's a bit speculative.
And we have to thank our bogs, because when a body is thrown into a bog, a dead body, it preserves it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the science of that?
As I say, I'm not a scientist, but one of the main factors is sphagnum moss and things like that. And it helps preserve the bodies. They're not perfectly preserved. They don't come out looking exactly like they did when they went in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tissues being dried. So it gives the faces a kind of contorted kind of aspect as such. But
for people who haven't seen him, he does look like Jim Carrey's representation of the Grinch.
Yeah, I guess.
Doesn't he? Yeah. That sort of elongated. And then the hair, because it's gelled, is up in a peak. Now, it may not have been that way when he died.
But you are looking at real hair from centuries ago, which in most normal circumstances would have just dissolved or decayed and left a skeleton.
And as you were saying, he had foodstuffs from places like France and Portugal.
Yeah, with bodies, you can often find out what's in their stomach and do analysis. And from that, you usually surmise that they don't usually eat meat back then, but often it's bread and wheat and agricultural products.
Yes.
But just from that basic observation, you can begin to learn so much about how people lived, how societies worked thousands and thousands of years ago, because obviously there's not many written records for that particular period. So things like bodies tell us things which would otherwise be lost to history.
Yeah, we might come back to Clonycarvan man later on, but we'll start at the top, I suppose, in our heads. And there were, I thought I knew everything about, I knew about phrenology, but I didn't know about trepanning. Is that how you pronounce it? Trepanning.
There's two ways of spelling and talking about it. So trepanning or trepanning with an H in the middle.
Tell us about that.
Well, that's a very ancient technique, usually used to cure what today we'd call mental illness. So basically it involves drilling a hole into the skull. Back in the day, they would have thought that that released evil spirits or pressure on the body. I'd imagine it's had some positive impacts, otherwise they wouldn't have kept on doing it. And as well, it wasn't necessarily a life-threatening thing to do, because you do get all these skulls which have been discovered with a hole in them, and they've had some growth on them since that person died.
So people
died.
Survived it?
Survived, yes.
Well, they wouldn't continue doing it if everybody died.
Sorry. So, yeah, the bones kept growing and the person obviously lived. We don't know much about the quality of life, if the mental health issues persisted or not. But it certainly...
The ultimate placebo effect. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to bore a hole in your skull and you're going to feel better after it.
But then again, just 100 years ago or so in the asylums, people were doing lobotomies
yes.
often with an ice pick, quite primitive. I mean, they claimed it was very scientific, but the methods were quite primitive in themselves. Usually didn't work too well. They were usually used in conjunction with ECT and other treatments at the time, coma therapies and all those kind of things. But like I mentioned in the book, you do wonder how far we really came, particularly in terms of mental health. Obviously, in the 19th century, we began to understand public health, physical health, disease, germs. Mm. But mental health has always been a bit more elusive, I think, partly because you can't really see it or in the same way.
I think you're right. It's only in the last 20 years, really, we're having decent conversations about mental health in this country. And we're still a long way to go. And our mental health services have a long way to go. But there was a physicality about it, wasn't it? Because like a long time ago, they didn't think that the brain was responsible for most. They thought that the digestive system was the...
Well, they used to think that the mind was in the stomach.
In the stomach,
yes. Until around the 17th or 18th centuries. And it's only really in the last 19th century, 20th century that we've begun to think, oh, our mind's in our brain. I don't know if that made us think differently or perceive our mind to be elsewhere. But no, it's fascinating because our bodies do change over time and our fundamental ideas about our bodies shift as the centuries progress. Mm. And it's that kind of... material which I've really tried to integrate into this book.
It is fascinating. I'm just wondering if people thought that their mind was in their stomachs, in their digestive system, that's probably because of the physical reaction to worry and things like that. Was that it?
I think so. Before I wrote this a long time ago, I wrote a book on the history of the stomach, which is more about British history. So, but since then, we've developed ideas about the microbiome, which is all the microbes and all those things in the gut and this kind of ecosystem within our guts. And nowadays, scientists have developed a lot of research which says that this influences our mood and our emotions and our minds. So actually, this old idea that maybe the mind was in the stomach isn't quite
as mad as it might seem. Seeing as you brought up the stomach, there is a chapter on the stomach in your book, A History of Ireland in 10 Body Parts. And of course, you speak about the potato at length and the famine. There was a famine 100 years prior to the Great Famine. Yeah. And we got out of that. And then this is the thing that probably will refer to you as well. A lot of the quotes in the book are from English writers who came over to observe how we lived in this country, which is probably what you're doing as well. And they painted a picture of this sort of lazy, slovenly, over potato eating people. And the potato was much maligned, wasn't it?
It was. And you're right, there is a long tradition of English people coming over and not liking what they see or making derogatory comments. And it's not just Ireland, obviously. During the colonial period, people go to Africa or Asia and say other things about the Chinese communities, Indian communities. But yeah, the potato was blamed for all of Ireland's social and economic problems at the time. And obviously, it was a lot more complicated than that. There is a long tradition. James Johnson is one doctor who I wrote about in that book. Now, he's from Ireland, but he goes over to England, becomes quite prominent. I think he's attending to Queen Victoria for a while in the 1840s. And he's one of these, even though he's Irish, I guess you could call him more Anglo-Irish at that stage. And he also shares these views about the peasantry in particular. I mean, it is about Irishness in one from one perspective, but it's also... an ongoing debate about poverty as well.
Yes.
And looking down at the classes below, blaming them for their own conditions. So there's two things.
But of course, they got it wrong because we now know that the potato is actually quite a good food stuff. It has fiber, it has vitamin C. Like, I've spoken to people over the years who've lived on a diet of nothing other than potatoes. So it wasn't as bad as they thought. But back in the day, people used to feed their pigs on potatoes. And of course, when people came and saw that people were eating the same as pigs, that, you know, it allowed them to write all sorts of terrible things about us.
But it actually makes sense to feed your pig well, because eventually when that pig becomes your source of meat, and you use that pig for bacon eventually, of course, if you've got a healthy pig being raised on potatoes, that's brilliant. And another interesting story is in the 19th century, when you went into prison, you always got measured to see what height you were. And obviously, as a historian, you can look at these records over time and you realise that after the famine, people did become shorter in Ireland. So you can see that particularly amongst the criminal class. But even by the late 19th century, there's loads of debates about whether or not national health has declined. So people lived in poverty before the famine, obviously, and that's a bad thing, but people seemed healthier.
We were like, I remember reading a survey from, we were one of the healthiest nations in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And in other countries like Italy in the 19th century, the government actually encouraged people to eat potatoes for reasons such as the obvious health-giving properties. Whereas obviously in Ireland, and particularly with the influence of the British government, and there was a huge drive to discourage people from living or subsisting alone on potatoes.
You mentioned height there, that's a chapter as well. Charles Byrne was 7'7", and there was a few well known Irish giants. They all died young because they were very unhealthy, but they made money out of the fact that people wanted to just look at them.
Essentially, we're actually a bit confused about how tall he was, because when they were publicising the shows, they would often claim, oh, I'm 8'5", 8'6". So, and obviously you got there and they were a little bit shorter, but still tall, and particularly tall for the time in the 18th century. People were a lot shorter than they would be today. So to be 7 foot and upwards was seen as quite miraculous or something of interest and something people wanted to look at. But like you said, these people tended to die. I think Charles Byrne died at 22, I think it was, which is remarkably young. He'd packed a lot in. He'd met the Queen. He'd been to London, put himself on the stage, but he was getting loads of problems in his knee joints, for instance, because of the weight placed upon them, and all sorts of problems connected to that. And the kind of people who did go and put themselves on display tended to die in the 20s. So,
and he foresaw that people would be fascinated by his corpse. So he planned that he would be put into a lead coffin and buried at sea. But a man named Hunter stepped in.
There's a big family in Scotland of doctors in the 18th century, the Hunter family, and John is one of these. Yeah, at the time, anatomy is becoming very popular amongst doctors. So if you've got a really unusual body, for instance, the elephant man is a different example of that. But if you're particularly tall, then you're like an anatomist dream. They want to go and display you. And after your death, they would kind of slice all your skin and flesh off and put you on display, just as a very tall skeleton. And Charles Byrne was displayed until quite recently in that sense. But it was if you had a medical museum, that was like, you know, as you come in, that would be the first thing you see would be this body. So there was many reasons why you'd want to secure any skeleton. That looks interesting.
And that's why there were body snatchers back in the day, because medical science had this insatiable appetite for dead bodies.
Yeah. But again, going back to poverty, it tended to be people from the workhouses or people who we would understand as vulnerable today, whose bodies tended to be taken away or tended to be dug up in the graveyards because they couldn't afford to be buried with quite the same paraphernalia as middle class to upper class people. Middle class people used to maybe, you know, have watchtowers or have gates around the graves, and they would kind of pursue that until the body had decayed. But obviously, if you're from a poorer family, your body's more vulnerable to being taken away and literally body snatched and then being dissected, put on display.
The ultimate indignity if you didn't want it to happen.
It was.
I think I'd heard about this before, but it's brilliant. It reminded me of Weekend at Bernie's. You know that movie where they're carrying around a dead man because they're trying to make everybody believe he's alive? So that's how when they got a dead body to transport from one place to another, they used to flank him with two men, dress him up and pretend he was drunk.
Pretty much, yeah. And it seemed to work by all accounts most of the time.
There's a lot of dark stuff in this, Ian, isn't there in the book? Yes, yeah. Do you enjoy that element of it?
I do. It is dark, but it's also fun as well.
Well, it wasn't fun at the time, I suppose. Those two Scottish brothers, for example, they saw a gap in the market for newly dead bodies.
Burke and Hur, yes. The fresher the body, the more the anatomist would pay you, of course. So quite famously, Burke and Hur decided to maybe not wait until someone had died, but to hurry the process along by murdering them. So there was a huge controversy in the 1820s. So I think around 10 people ended up being murdered. And they made a lot of money by taking these fresh corpses to the anatomist. Robert Knox in Edinburgh, again, so another Scottish doctor. One of them got hanged and the other went missing.
They weren't brothers. Both of them were called William. Sorry about that.
So, they weren't related.
And the Irish connection is that a poor Donegal woman went to Edinburgh in search of her son. And they ended up befriending her and offering her board, and then they murdered her.
But the doctor is interesting. His name is Robert Knox. And going back to what you were saying earlier, he was one of these people from Britain who went off to different countries and decided to write about what he saw. So his career wasn't affected by the scandals or anything like that. So even in the 1840s, he's writing about people in Africa and how they appear different from people in Britain in the not too dissimilar way to, like we were saying before, the travel writers from Britain.
And you write about the Inishbofin skulls as well.
Yeah.
So it was Haddon and Dixon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about them.
There's an underlying story within the book, which I was really fascinated by. And it concerns how around 100, 120 years ago, people began to look back to the ancient Irish past and begun to imagine it in different ways. And then they begun to imagine maybe places like the Aran Islands, very remote places. Maybe that's where you can find the kind of original Irish person as such, whose DNA hasn't been affected by the British mostly or
So it's pure Irish.
Yeah, that's what they imagined people to be living there. Now, of course, it was things like that simple, and it was essentially kind of fiction, but it was the broader context of the Cultural Revolution, the lead up to independence, the kind of searching for an Irish national identity, and body parts come into that. Skulls, for instance. They didn't do much with these skulls apart from endlessly measure them and then publish the results of what they found. But they did think that by doing that, they could begin to understand how people looked and behaved centuries and centuries ago. And like I said, going back to this kind of almost Irish prototype, but it's all very imaginary. So there's that part of the story I'm telling is about how people think back about the past and reconstruct, often using the body, reconstruct ideas about.
It's all because, when does respect wane for a dead body? Do you know what I'm saying? Because come back to Cluny Cavan man, so he's up there on display. He probably wouldn't have liked that when he was alive, but it's hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So at what stage is it? Is it 100 years? Is it 200 years? Is it,
I think that's a difficult question. You might ask, did we ever have respect for dead bodies in the first place if we're putting giants on display or throwing bodies into bogs? So I don't know how I might turn
that
question around.
But we reassess that because he's Charles Byrne. That's been taken down, hasn't it? And the Inishbofin skulls have been returned to. So I suppose we're looking at it differently now, with more respect.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is to do with the debate about colonialism and the colonial legacy in museums, which is going on, in various places, including Ireland. So the return of the Inishbofin skulls is part of regaining a respect, I guess, for the people on that island in this instance who wanted those skulls returned. They were stolen unnecessarily by someone from Trinity College. For their own purposes, essentially. So there is a lot of, it's that broader picture of colonialism and thinking, how do we put on display things that were essentially stolen from other countries or places?
There's fascinating, there's legs. In the legs chapter, you tell us that Mike Flatley insured his legs for $40 million when he was at his peak. And also this notion of dance-offs between two dance masters. Go on.
There is a lot of dancing, and you mentioned the book being dark, but there is also a lot of cultural stuff in there. And
yeah.
as you say, about dancing at the time. But Irish dancing, I mean, it's part of these traditions which go in and out of fashion, but sometimes whoever's governing the country or the church wants to put a stop to. The church in particular got very worked up about jazz dancing in the 1930s. So there's a long history
of
not wanting any, and a lot of it's to do with young people specifically dancing, and you know, young people of the opposite sex, you know, so there's that kind of control of sexuality and those kind of debates. And
the Catholic Church has mentioned a good bit as well. It was interesting to read that under Breton law, we were a lot more liberal. Women were treated a lot better. There was divorce. In Celtic times, we were a lot more free with our bodies, etc. And along came the church, and all of those things changed.
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up. The ancient Irish laws do seem to have been more favourable to women, whereas in the 19th century, it was very difficult to get a divorce, and even in the periods when divorce was legalised, you know, it was very expensive. The woman tended to come off quite badly. She may not be able to see her children anymore. So even in periods of legalisation, it's not been as liberal as you may have hoped. Now, of course, I don't want to go back and romanticise the ancient times, but it does seem that the Breton law in these instances were more favourable to women.
Yeah. And we didn't get to talk about Sheila Na Gigg, Bram Stoker's brother, Oscar Wilde's dad. It's all like there's just so much fascinating stuff in this, and you can take a chapter at a time. You don't have to read it in sequence. It's a big book. It's a big book. A most compelling and truly remarkable read, says Professor Luke O'Neill. That's a great recommendation. And one of the things that death is another one, corpses, and your experience of an Irish wake, because we do things differently here, don't we?
Yeah, as an English person, certainly spending time with a body still in the room was something I got used to, I guess. But there is a kind of big cultural difference often between Ireland and Britain. And I particularly noticed that coming here and learning about particular traditions, especially the traditions surrounding death and funerals and wakes. But that's all in there too.
I better give them the it'll be interesting just before we leave you. It's a history of Ireland in 10 body parts. So it's height, hands, heads and skulls, legs, sexual organs, blood, brains, stomachs, ears, corpses. There's mention of a castration in there as well, just people that might get people excited. A history of Ireland in 10 body parts. Dr. Ian Miller, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.